Welcome to Film Fragments, a podcast where we take a look at an actor, director, and genre and tell you our favorites from their catalog. My name is Brian Suffield. I'm your host, and I'm very excited to welcome you guys to this week's episode of Film Fragments, where today we're going to be talking about our favorite films starring Paul Giamatti in honor of The Holdovers coming to theaters very, very soon. I'm super excited to delve into the career of Paul Giamatti. I'm very excited to talk to you guys about my favorite star and this wonderfully gifted actor. And I'm also excited to welcome today's guest. Our guest today is Ben Miller. He is a member of the North Texas Film Critics Association, as well as the International Film Society Critics. He is the owner of Ice Cream for Freaks and the host of the Target Audience podcast. But he also refers to himself as the David Wells of podcasting, which, you know, when I saw that, I was like, I wonder why that is. But then I look at him. I'm literally looking at him right now as we speak. And I'm like, yeah, I can see the resemblance. So, Ben, Ben, welcome to the show.
I appreciate it. You know, it's funny. I never thought of myself actually looking like David Thewlis. And then now you said it, I'm like, I don't not look like David Thewlis. So
well, as a huge Potterhead, I will always be excited whenever someone puts any actor from those movies in their bio or description or what have you. So,
well, it's funny. my big thing behind that wasn't necessarily like that I look like him. It was more like, you know, every time – it's kind of what this – podcast is all about. Like, anytime you see David Thewlis in a movie, you're like, hey, David Thewlis, I like David Thewlis, but he's never the star of a movie generally.
That is true.
So, like, even on my own podcast, I'm not the main attraction. It's always my guest. And even whenever I'm on, I'm just like, ah, you know, it's nice to see me around, but nobody's like, yeah, signing up for Ben to come on this podcast. Well, so I was like, no reason. I like to be the character actor of the podcast world.
Well, hey, you're going to be the main attraction for this podcast today.
I love it.
So.
This is my naked. This is my Mike Lee's naked. So
Mike Lee's naked from 1993 or whatever year it came out.
I really hope it's not my Island of Dr. Moreau, but let's...
So, talking about our topic today of Paul Giamatti, actually, before we get into talking about Paul Giamatti, I would just love for you to introduce yourself to the audience and talk about what you do, what got you into film, and why you love it so much.
You know, it's one of those things, it's hard to look back and say what was like the, you know, the linchpin moment to get me into film, but whenever I think about it, you know, my mom was always a big movie buff, and probably... was a good way to segment, get me into that world initially. And then I remember my first, like, big theatrical experience, and I was, like, 7. And my dad comes over, he's like, hey, we're going to go watch this movie. And the sound in there, it's going to be like dinosaurs are right over your shoulder. And I'm 7. I'm like, yeah, let's do this. And it was Jurassic Park. And sure enough, I was like, this is incredible. And my mom, instead of, we obviously didn't have iPads when we were younger, so my mom... whenever he had to do something around the house, she'd pop in whatever VHS we had around. So there are all these classic kid movies like Five Goes West and Hook and all those kind of kids movies from that era when I was young that we watched all the time. Then as I got a little older, it's like I was still a big movie buff. But whenever I would go to my grandmother's house, she's very artistic. Well, both my brothers are really artistic. I can't really draw a stick figure. So they'd pull out the papers and start all this artistic stuff. And then my grandma, knowing this, it's like I'd draw, doodle my hand, make an eyeball, whatever it is. And they're like, well, go to I got a book down there at the end. And it's an almanac. She kind of knew my nature of like being more analytic. And I found the Oscars history in there. And I'm like, this is interesting. Why is this in an almanac? And I kind of like, oh, these are movies. Okay, cool, cool, cool. And I kind of just went along with that. And then just never didn't fall in love with movies and worked at a movie theater whenever I was in high school. Kind of segued my way into, I'd been writing, here and there, and then started segueing my way into, film criticism. The first movie I actually ever wrote a review on was Independence Day Resurgence.
Oh.
I wrote about how terrible it was, because it was bad. Cause I had such nostalgia for the original Independence Day.
Right.
And that one just kind of crapped all over it, and I was like, okay, well, this is what it is. So then I started writing for the Film Experience, started writing more and more, got started writing with Cinema Scholars, and then made my own site, got in, and then here we are. I'm still the fledgling film critic that I barely was, with a little bit more credence, that's essentially my journey to this point.
What a story, Mark. What a great What a great story. No, that's awesome. That's so cool. It is unfortunate that your first review was for a dumpster fire, but
really
hey.
Is. Well, it's where I truly learned that, like, if you love a movie, if you have so much passion for it, it's easy to write a review for that.
Yes.
If a movie is a crap burger, super easy to write a review for that. It's the middle grounds that are tough.
Oh, 100%.
Three stars, 3.5 stars, those are tough movie reviews to write.
Oh, they're terrible. So I used to do YouTube movie reviews, and always doing the reviews for the mid movies was incredibly difficult.
Yeah.
Incredibly difficult.
And there's so many of those mid movies.
I know.
And you're just like, well, I'm going to watch this.
Right.
And it's like, what do you think? It was good. And
it was fine.
It was fine. Like, and what do you have to say about that? It was fine. Like, yeah, it's a lot easier to be super passionate one way or the other about things.
Oh, 100%. So, my thoughts exactly.
Yeah.
And speaking of things that we are passionate about, Paul Giamatti.
My man.
One of the great actors working today. In my opinion, a criminally underrated actor. People know who he is. People know his name. But I think people fail to recognize him as one of the best actors that we have in this business right now. He's a fantastic character actor. He has done he's done everything.
Pretty much.
I mean, yep. he's done big films. He's done small films. He's done comedies. He's done dramas. He's done action movies. He's done thrillers. He even did a musical. He's done it all.
Yep.
And he voiced a testicle on Big Mouth.
Sure. One is to do, yes.
Exactly. The range right there. That is so much range. So to pose the question to you, why do you think a lot of people, even though he doesn't get as much notoriety as he should, why do you think a lot of people get excited whenever they see Paul Giamatti's name attached to a project? And what makes you such a fan of Paul Giamatti? What's your history with Paul Giamatti?
You know, he's just one of those guys that has such a definitive face. Like, nobody is ever denying Paul Giamatti's face in real, like, I think it's kind of one of the reasons he's probably not as renowned or well-known as an actor. Because people could probably be like, oh, he's traditionally ugly or whatever the features or whatever that is. But at the same time, like, they always say about movie stars and actors in general, you want to have big features. And this guy is nothing but features. But the unbearable talent behind it is backed up. Like, he can be under a lot of makeup or facial hair or in certain situations where it's all just, like, he gives credibility to everything. Like, he's a guy who does not stray from what he does well. You're never like, well, Paul Giamatti was miscast. It's never the case. He's always exactly he seems like one of the more self-aware actors we have in the world. Like, he knows his role in the world of Hollywood, and he is perfectly willing to slide into those roles that he expected him to. And from the beginning, he's just like, you know what? This is the kind of guy I am, and I'm going to work. I'm just going to pepper, 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 pepper. And, like, I know we'll talk about some of these movies, but, I look at the things that most people have seen him in, and I look at, like, My Best Friend's Wedding, The Truman Show, Saving Private Ryan, 12 Years a Slave. He's in those movies for 5 minutes, if that, and he makes such an indelible impression. Like, the most people, the first time they'd ever seen Paul Giamatti is My Best Friend's Wedding. And it's Julia Roberts crying and smoking in this hallway, and then the nice, friendly bellhop comes over, you're like, oh, what a nice little change of pace. Like, who's that guy? Like, what a sweet little, you know, aside to this movie that you kind of had these certain expectations, and you're immediately interested. You're like, well, where's the bellhop? Like, what's this guy's story? There's got to be more to that. Same thing, like, in the Truman Show when he's messing around with the different screen ideas, and just to, like, he has more into it going on. It's not just what's on the surface. There's so much going on behind the surface, and he's just so much more interesting than most people you see on screen.
Yeah, I've loved him pretty much my whole life. As a kid, in the Sudfield household, me and my sister would watch Big Fat Liar.
Oh yeah,
constantly, and it's a film that me and her hold near and dear to our hearts, even still as adults, which is saying a lot. Is it a film that's on either of our lists? Tune in to find out. But you know, watching that film, I just saw there was just something about this guy. Even as a little kid, I'm like, you know, there's something about this man. This man, you know, the commitment that he went through to essentially dye himself blue and just do all the shenanigans that that character goes through is really awe-inspiring. And then as I got older and I started taking my love of film more seriously and I started delving into his career and seeing all these eclectic turns that he would do in films like Sideways and Cinderella Man and all those supporting roles that you mentioned, it was just so incredible to see him go from being this essentially a character actor to then taking on these leading roles and just showing the world that he's more than a character actor, he's an actor. Like, he has so much talent bestowed upon him, and he's showcasing it to all of us watching all of his movies. And he could have such an impact, like you said, regardless of how big or small the role is, because you brought up him in My Best Friend's Wedding, Saving Private Ryan, The Truman Show, and he has all these smaller supporting roles too, but then he also kicks butt in leading roles. And he is a guy that could be in a film that is so terrible, but he is never the weak spot of it.
Never, never.
He's always one of the glowing aspects of the movies. Like, you could talk about a film like Lady in the Water or San Andreas or some of these other silly, goofy films. No complaints about Paul.
Guy never mails it in. He never mails it in. He is committed to to what he is trying to do.
100%. And then even on the television side of things, you know, he's currently on that show Billions, which is a hugely popular show. He got so much love for what he did in John Adams. He even got an Emmy nomination for his appearance in Downton Abbey. There's so much range from this guy, and I respect him so much. I genuinely believe that he is one of the most underrated actors working today. Again, even though people know his name and they know who Paul is,
yeah,
they don't give him the credibility that he quite frankly deserves. He deserves to be on the same level as some of these other actors that people talk about like they're God's gift to acting.
Yes, and I agree.
He really is one of the greats. I'm so excited to delve into his career.
Let's do it.
I'm so excited. Let's just get right into it. Let's go. Let's do it. Okay, so Ben, what is your number five favorite Paul Giamatti film of all time?
My favorite Paul Giamatti film, number five, is Straight Outta Compton. The the NWA biopics in general, especially nowadays, are always real dicey because it's always like, well, we want to do a warts and all version of this story. And it's like, well, if you do a warts and all version, the people who have the music rights won't give you the music rights. And you're having a Jackie Jorp situation where, or a, the Jimmy All Is By My Side situation where you can't get any of the music, but you can, but nobody cares because the music's kind of what gets them in there. And with Straight Outta Compton, you can tell, you're like, well, Dr. Dre and Ice Cube were fully involved in the story about this. It's like, yeah, they, all the stuff that makes them look cool, it shows, but all the stuff, the darker stuff, any of the criminal aspects, or the, not even the criminal aspects, the non-cool criminal aspects, aren't shown. But the thing that Straight Outta Compton does, it puts these, the five actors who play NWA are all so just fascinating as a group. And it puts, you can kind of look over the problems with the story. Giamatti comes in knowing exactly what role he is trying to play. He's like, you are the square white dude in a sea of black. And he's like, yep, I am on board with it. I know what this calls for. And I am going into this with eyes wide open. And he does not ever come across as a guy who was trying to swindle. Like, it's interesting because the idea of Jerry Heller in general is like a guy who's like, oh, he is probably like the Colonel Tom Parker of the 20s, of the 90s. But at the same time, the movie and Giamatti's credibility, you're like, he plays it as like, you're the hero of your own story, and he never really plays it to the point of like, oh, this is obviously a villainous role. He really puts some pathos into it, and and sells it in such a way where you're like, I'm never on board with him being the full out villain. I understand where he's coming from.
I love that movie so much, and it pains me to not put it on my list. I really adore Straight Outta Compton. You want to talk about one of the better music biopics that we've gotten in the past decade, where we've been bombarded with music biopic one after the other? I really think that this might be the best one. It honestly might take the cake for me of being the best. And I didn't, prior to watching this, like, I was obviously very familiar with NWA.
Sure.
I never was an extensive listener of their music, but I obviously recognized the impact that they had on the music industry and everything. And, you know, for someone who wasn't super well-rounded with their music, the movie found a beautiful way of catering to fans of the subject, but also bringing us into that world and making us so enamored and engrossed by what's being depicted on screen. And I really love the movie. And specifically to talk about Paul Giamatti, he was great in this. And, you know, he's always a great presence, like we've been talking about these last few minutes. But I really love the gravitas that's added to the character of Jerry Heller, where, mm-hmm. you know, you're introduced to him and you could tell that he really wants to help build these guys' career, but then you could see the slimy, shady side of him. But then there's moments throughout the movie where you actually see that there might be some good in this guy, particularly the sequence where they're just outside the recording studio and those cops come up to them and everything. And he just basically tells the cops to fuck off. And he's like, you can't do this and everything. Like, this is so unacceptable and everything. And that's one of my favorite sequences in the entire film.
Sure.
Because it showcases how good of a person Jerry Heller was, or to our belief. But yeah, it's a great film. And it's beautifully directed. It's beautifully written. And the cast, everyone, round of applause to everyone. Hmm. Everyone was so worried, myself included, and maybe you were too, when they announced, Ice Cube's son is going to play Ice Cube in this movie. We're all like, oh my God, really?
Now with the benefit of hindsight, we're like, well, obviously, he's a great actor in everything else he's been in.
he's one of the good Nepo babies that we have right now.
Exactly. Nepo babies specifically,
he's one of the greats. And
I'll defend as far as Nepo babies, he's definitely on the side I'm willing to defend.
100%. And, you know, the thing that still blows my mind about this movie is that it got an Oscar nomination for Best Screenplay, which I think is one of the coolest Oscar nominations of the past 10 years, because nobody predicted that this was even going to be an Oscar player at all. I bet you everyone watching this movie was like, the Academy's not going to recognize the biopic about NWA, of right. all people. And they gave it a screenplay nomination. And while we're at it, they should have given Jason Mitchell a Best Supporting Actor nomination for his work as Eazy-E.
Yep, and then didn't the SAG ensemble SAG ensemble
nominated? It got nominated, which is another incredibly cool nomination.
Yeah, I agree. That's a cool nomination to have. Like, but yeah, it's way better than it has any right to be.
Oh, absolutely. And it's funny too, because Paul Giamatti did another music biopic around that time in Love and Mercy, where he also played essentially the manager of a music figure, where he was kind of shady and slimy with his
he was much worse in Love and Mercy.
Yeah, Straight Outta Compton is a great pick. And my number five is also a biographical tale, but it's not a music biopic, it's a straight up biopic. My number five is American Splendor from 2003, where he plays Harvey Peckard, the comic book artist behind the infamous comic series American Splendor. And, you know, this is an interesting biopic because it's not told in your conventional biopic way. It definitely follows the tropes of a biopic, but the cool thing that it does with it is that it incorporates the real life Harvey, who narrates the film, and then it would occasionally cut back to him being interviewed by the directors alongside his wife, which I thought was so impressive. I thought that was a really fascinating way of taking the biopic approach and adding your own spin to it. And this was what I believe to be the first major leading role in Paul's career, where he was the star of the movie. And it's a great performance, and it's also a very, very fun movie. It's breezy, it goes by very quickly, it's entertaining, there's a lot of heart to it, there's a lot of great comedy to it. There's also some cringy humor to it, which is very intentional, especially that first date between him and Hope Davis. It's like, oh, it's so cringy where he brings her back to her his place and then she pukes and everything. And you could just tell that the guy has so much passion for bringing stories to life, and he's also struggling because he's in the midst of a second divorce and he's working a dead-end job. He's basically your average Joe. He's working this schlubby job. He looks like a schlub, but there's so much gravitas to him. And I really think that if you're going to do a biopic and add a cool spin to it, this is the way of pulling it off successfully. Shout out to the directors and the writers. They're actually documentarians, so they decided to step up and do something differently. And another cool addition to this film was the sequences where you would see the animation throughout it. It's a very cool spin, especially one of the sequences that stands out to me is when he's in the supermarket and he's behind the old Jewish woman, and then you see him in the background just like screaming. Then you see the animated version of him saying, "Come on, do something, do something." And it's so great. It's wonderful. And Paul knocks it out of the park as usual. I think he just adds so many layers to the work of Harvey Pekar. And yeah, I think it's one of the coolest biopics that I've seen in recent memory. I just watched this for the first time very recently, and I really dug it, and I definitely look forward to checking it out again. And again, I think it's cool that we would cut back to the real Harvey Pekar and then also Toby Radloff, and I forgot who played him in the movie. Oh, Judah
Judah
Friedlander.
Friedlander, yeah,
Yeah,
the
so good.
world champion, yeah.
Do not eat my White Castle cheeseburgers. I have to eat dinner super late tonight.
Another movie that got a surprise screenplay nomination.
Yes, a very cool screenplay nomination. And it lost to probably one of the best films ever made, Return of the King. So, hey,
I
can't
like
complain there.
I don't hate American Splendor. It just kind of falls into that quagmire of like early 2000s quirk, indie quirk.
Did somebody
And
say quagmire?
but I mean, like, you had a lot of those type of movies, like the indie directors who are like, I'm trying something, or not even necessarily trying something. It's just kind of like you get lost in the mix of all those kind of indie-esque films. Like
Yeah.
you think of like The Station Agent and Secret Life of Dentists and Roger Dodger, that those kind of mid low budget indies with respected character actors. And I think Giamatti is the one who actually elevates it more than anybody else. But like I said, once you get on board with what the movie is, it's really rewarding. I agree.
Yeah, it's very good. It's a film that I had put off for such a long time. And just watching it, being like, oh, it's essentially an adaptation of a comic book, but it's very different from all the other comic book movies that we've ever gotten. Because when you hear the term comic book movie, you think of superheroes and everything. And Harvey was always emphasizing, I don't want to make a comic about superheroes and cartoon animals and everything. I want to make a comic about just real everyday life. And I think that's fascinating because that's not the typical comic book that most people would read. People read stuff where there's action and fighting because they want to escape from what's going on in the real world. But then the fact that someone is bringing elements of their world into the pages for everyone to read, I think that's impressive. And it's really incredible to see what Harvey brought to it. I was really sad after watching this movie knowing that he's no longer with us. I had no idea that he had passed a few years ago. So, quite a legacy to leave upon us. And yeah, one of the coolest biopics that I've seen in recent memory for sure. So now going into our number fours, what is your pick?
It's a cliche to say, the one time the guy actually got Oscar accolades, but I always like the movie and I stand by it. It's Cinderella Man. Whenever you like, there are plenty of things you can nitpick with, and essentially Ron Howard making a incredibly old-fashioned film. It's essentially not only just a movie like depicting the Great Depression, it's it's like one, it's not even, for being 2005, it's not like a film showing the Great Depression with 2005 eyes. It's like a film showing the Great Depression with like 1950s eyes. It's a really, it's so old fashioned, and the way everything kind of progresses, it's so, it's like, it's fairly predictable. But at the same time, it's elevated by these elements, like the elements of the boxing scenes are remarkable. Russell Crowe is really, really good in it, and Giamatti is really, really good in it as well. Just because he brings this level of, you know, he's the guy who, you know, the second banana to Russell Crowe's boxer character, obviously, and that is his trainer. But the whole time, you're just like, the relationship between Giamatti and Crowe is such, and the chemistry between them is that you don't just care about the boxer, you care about the boxer and the trainer. They're like a combined function, and those two coming together is the thing that kind of roots you on in the movie. Yeah, it's a boxing movie, and you want the boxer to win, and the family, and all that kind of stuff. And the less we say about Renee Zellweger in that movie, the better. But regardless, Paul Giamatti's great. I'll defend Cinderella Man. I always will.
Yeah, I like Cinderella Man a lot, too. It's kind of baffling that this is the only Oscar nomination that he's received. And this is obviously not the only time that we'll bring up that topic. But, yeah, I really like Cinderella Man. I think it's a very cool boxing sports drama. It definitely follows the footsteps of your typical boxing sports drama. But I always found the story to be really interesting. The fact that it's a true story of James Braddock. And, you know, he's this popular boxer, and then all of a sudden the Great Depression happens, which obviously affects everybody, and you know, for him to bounce back, and then Paul Giamatti comes into the picture. I really like the movie a lot, and I think Ron Howard, when he's good, he's really good, but when he's bad, he's real bad.
What an odd, like, you want to talk that, you want to talk about a film fragments episode that would be wild, the Ron Howard movies.
Oh,
because like, just a guy that goes all over the place when it comes to just not only quality, but genre. Like, it's, there's no rhyme or reason to it. Like, the guy makes Apollo 13 and Ransom back to back. And Ransom is like almost shockingly violent. And Apollo 13 is like this old school, like, rousing movie you can watch with your grandparents. And then he follows that up with The Grinch, and then, you know, then you get like the traditional stuff like Beautiful Mind, Cinderella Man, and then other stuff, you're just like, well, it doesn't make a ton of sense. Like, why did he make the movie The Dilemma?
I was just about to say that. You read my mind.
if you look at everything on there, you're like, well, this makes sense. And then you'll see like EdTV. Why EdTV? Okay, whatever. Then The Dilemma, you're just like, what? And then you forget he made Hillbilly Elegy, and you're like, oh no. And I'm sure he's got another one, and it'll be another one where I'm like, well,
Ron,
who knows what it's going to be? It's going to be an animated movie. So I mean,
Ron, it all went downhill.
But like you said,
Ron, it went all downhill after you left Happy Days.
Now, don't get me wrong. Like, I can't watch Apollo 13 and not marvel at the technical mastery involved.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I can't not look at that and go, it's a remarkable achievement. He did everything right. And I can still look at A Beautiful Mind and say, cool, one of the five worst Best Picture winners in the history of the Oscars. Like, I can say both. So, you know,
is what it is. Oh, man. But yeah, Cinderella Man is a pretty good movie. It's a solid entry in Ron Howard's filmography, and it's also a solid entry in Paul Giamatti's filmography. So number four for me is interesting because, spoiler alert, this is a film that hasn't come out yet, but I've had the fortunate opportunity to see it, and you can't really do a Paul Giamatti ranking without putting this film on the list. And I feel like when Ben sees this movie, he's going to love it too. And obviously, I'll ask him his thoughts after I talk about it. So, as you could tell, my number four is The Holdovers, which I was very fortunate enough to see at TIFF. And it was my favorite film at the festival. It was the only film at the festival of the almost 30 movies that I saw that I gave 5 stars to, which is saying a lot. Because there were a lot of films that I saw at the festival that were very close to getting that perfect score for me. But this just crossed off everything that I love about film, and it had everything. First of all, it's a great Christmas movie, so that's the first thing. If you have a good Christmas movie, you literally warm up my heart. Second, Alexander Payne and Paul Giamatti working together again. I was so excited when I first heard about this project because, spoiler alert, the other collaboration between the two of them we'll obviously be talking about, but I was just so excited to see the two of them work together again, because I think when they work together, they create literal magic, and that was the case with The Holdovers. So, without saying too much, since obviously this film hasn't come out yet, it's one of the best films of the year. It's going to be a major awards player. Paul is incredible in it. He's fantastic. It's one of the best performances that he's ever given. He is so despicable in this film. So typical Paul Giamatti fashion, but he's also incredibly funny, but he's also very sincere. There are moments where you laugh at the stuff he says. There are moments where you're like, I fucking hate this guy. I cannot stand him. I want him to go away. But then there's actual moments where you genuinely feel bad for the guy. And the film does a beautiful job of painting a portrait of not only him, but two other broken people. They're all broken in their own ways. And it's such a moving character study. It's very warm and cozy. You like to have a big hug and everything. It's essentially like Good Vibes the movie. That's what you get when you watch this movie. And, you know, I am not going to say that this is going to be, like, nominated for every Oscar. But I will say this right now. If Paul Giamatti does not get nominated for this movie, then they're doing themselves a huge disservice by not nominating him, because this is one of the best performances, not only of his career, but it's also one of the best performances of the entire year that you'll see. And the chemistry that he has with his two co-stars, Divine Joy Randolph, and especially newcomer Dominic Cesar, are off the charts good. It's one of the best films of the year.
I could see it next week. I'm very much looking forward to it.
I'm so excited for you to see it. I love it so much. And really, it's so great. It has everything that you love about Alexander Payne. Something that we were clearly missing from the Matt Damon Shrinking movie, which doesn't exist. So I don't know what I'm talking about right now. But no, it has everything that you love about Alexander Payne's work. He balances the comedy and drama very beautifully and very seamlessly. There's a lot of gut punch funny moments throughout this movie, but there's also moments that genuinely make you bawl and moments that really make you moved. So, yeah, I cannot stress enough how incredible this film is and how excited I am for everyone to see it. And posing the question to you, Ben, how excited are you to see The Holdovers? Because you just brought up that you're seeing it very, very soon, but why are you looking forward to watching this film?
Well, I mean, Alexander Payne is such a fascinating filmmaker in what he wants to get across. He always has a very specific idea of what, essentially breaking down human nature in a certain way. Like, be it, he's really interested in pathetic characters. Like, he's like, I'm going to take somebody in a very normal setting and show how pathetic they are. And then I'm going to wrap these circumstances around and see how they squirm. And essentially, that's, you know, what you can go back to Election. You go back to, obviously, other films we're going to be talking about this. And then in The Holdovers, it seems like he's staying in that tradition. Like, he's kind of going back to what he knows. And instead of, like, with Downsizing, it was kind of like, well, he's kind of venturing outside of a lane. And like, I know a lot of people don't like The Descendants for some reason, but like when I look at The Descendants, I'm like, well, he almost got there, except it's really hard to make a guy like George Clooney seem pathetic. So that's kind of the in-between, but Giamatti is kind of the perfect vessel for what Payne likes to get across. And the idea of the reality, you know, the idea of somebody being pathetic on screen, or just that level of, like, I don't want to watch this person, but then Payne will peel back these layers and show, like, what this person is actually like in reality and how you can actually relate to this person. And that's always fascinating to me. And I love Giamatti. I love Divine Joy Randolph. She's great in everything I ever see her in. And anytime I get a chance to see her, especially when she gets great reviews, I'm all for it. So I'm going in with an open mind and excited for it.
Yeah, I can't wait for you to see it. I hope to hear your thoughts when you do check it out. I cannot wait. I will definitely be like, you better tell me if you like the holdovers or not. And if you hate the holdovers, you need to lie to me. I'm just kidding. But no, I'm very excited for you to see it. I cannot wait to hear your thoughts on it. I feel like you're definitely going to be wowed by it and definitely going to be celebrating and praising it for sure. So now transitioning to our number threes, what is your pick?
My number three is the magician movie from 2006 that is not The Prestige. It is The Illusionist. The Illusionist, I love. It's The Prestige is, you get all those movies all the time where it's like Dante's Peak and Volcano and Armageddon, Deep Impact and all that kind of stuff. And obviously, being a Christopher Nolan movie, The Prestige always gets the nod of the two magician movies, but I love The Illusionist. I think Neil Berger is one of the more underrated directors who doesn't, he never really had this, he makes some pretty cool stuff that you see a lot of, you see some potential. And then he got wrapped up in the Divergent series and kind of went in different directions. But I mean, but The Illusionist is such a cool ass movie that is so much deeper and better in different ways than you'd ever expect. It's Jessica Biel's best film performance. It's Edward Norton in this weird in between of where he realizes he's not going to be the Marlon Brando that everybody kind of expected him to be, but he's not the character actor he's kind of in these days. He's kind of in that in between, but he's still invested in it, and he's really great. And then Giamatti, it's the first time he kind of gets to be a authority figure with power, where his authority is questioned, but it's not one of those, you can tell, a lot of times, we're talking about Love and Mercy and Straight Outta Compton and stuff like that, and you're like, well, this guy is the bad guy, despite not him thinking he's the bad guy. But in The Illusionist, it's an entirely different dynamic, because Inspector Uhl is essentially, he's played by Paul Giamatti, and the way he's playing him, Giamatti can be very shouty. He's not shouty in this. He is reserved and settled. And that level of authority in that settling is really what brings it out for me. Every time I see him in this movie, I was like, he's so incredible in this movie. Just his level of authenticity with quiet and just kind of like the bravado he has. It's a great performance by him, and I love the movie.
So this is unfortunately one that I have not seen. I've always wanted
to see. Ah, shame.
I know. And it's so sad because I love Paul. I love Edward Norton. Jessica Biel, she's fine. But, I always have heard about this movie being the other magician movie from 06. Yep. And everyone was talking about The Prestige. And I love The Prestige. I'm a huge fan of that movie. One of my favorite Nolan films for sure. But I need to check out The Illusionist. I think what's thrown me off from watching it is the fact that Neil Berger directed it. I hate Divergent. I hate Divergent so much. I really do. I'm sure Neil Berger definitely has some talent in him, but there's not as much talent there as I thought. Yeah, The Illusionist, I'm sure, is great. I mean, Limitless, I really enjoy. I do enjoy that one. That's a solid Bradley Cooper outing for sure. And he's obviously a prominent person involved with the show Billions. But The Upside? Good God. What is that? Why would you remake a film Untouchables?
It's a movie that made well over $100 million is what it made. That guy gets the bag. The problem with The Upside is a great example. It's a movie that everybody expected, being like, oh, the Untouchables, we're going to remake it for American audiences. And we're like, oh man, this is going places. And I just think everybody just had the wrong expectations, because The Untouchables being the kind of movie it is and The Upside being kind of the movie it is, they're two wildly different movies.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Neil Berger was a hired hand. Divergent didn't work out. I don't want to be in movie jail. Let me do the thing for you studio guys. It'll be a nice little side thing here. And I'll do it, and then you can let me do something else.
Yeah.
And this is my interpretation of it. But I mean, the movie made $108 million in the United States. It made plenty of money. Like, it's everybody just kind of looks at it and goes, well, it's not the Untouchables. I don't think it was trying to be. I think it's perfectly fine. My grandparents would have loved it.
Yeah, I haven't seen The Upside, and as much as I love Bryan Cranston, I can't do it. I can't do it. But The Illusionist sounds like a Neil Berger film that I will very much enjoy, so I will absolutely check that out very, very soon.
Please,
for sure.
Yes.
So my number three is a film that I will never understand why he didn't get a nomination for, or why this film was talked about more by more people. And that is Private Life from 2018, directed by Tamara Jenkins, co-starring him and Catherine Hahn. They're an older couple who have been trying to have a kid for a very, very, very long time. And in the midst of all these things, of all these attempts to have a kid and everything, they realize that the best option might be to get a donor. And then they find this donor in their niece, who they essentially become parental figures to. And she becomes essentially the child that they have always wanted. And I just watched this for the first time a couple of days ago, and I absolutely loved it so much. It is such a shame that Netflix was behind this film and didn't push this as hard as they quite frankly should have. Now, this was in the same year that Roma came out, and that was obviously Netflix's major award player that season. I understand. Biographical tale, Alfonso Cuarón, who was an Oscar darling and everything. Tamara Jenkins was also an Oscar darling, too. She had previously directed The Savages, which is a fucking great movie, by the way. A great movie that
yes.
got a screenplay nomination. And this got no love. And some of the best acting from Paul Giamatti is here in this movie. And he is so good as this guy who's been kind of struggling as an artist, but then he also is going through this personal struggle of trying to have a kid with his wife. Who, by the way, I mean, this is a Paul Giamatti podcast, and we'll definitely glow about him for sure throughout the rest of this podcast, but I need to just take a pause on talking about him for a second and acknowledge how fucking incredible Catherine Hahn is in this movie. She is so,
I've heard nothing but good things about Catherine Hahn in Private Life.
She is amazing in this. Amazing in this. And you tend to forget that this is the same woman who's done all these comedies from like the early 2000s to now. And I love that she's established herself as an actor who is capable of showing these incredible dramatic chops. Even in WandaVision, she was awesome in that. She was like genuinely, she was fun to watch in that show, but she also gave a legit great performance. And even though I've fallen off the bandwagon with the MCU, I am kind of excited to see her reprise that role again when she gets her spinoff show, The Agatha Show, and what have you. But yeah, she's incredible, and she and Paul work off each other very, very beautifully. And there's a particular moment in this movie where after they receive bad news, the doctors are recommending that Catherine Hahn goes through this particular procedure and everything. And then Paul's like, maybe we should do it. And the quote that is said between the two of them is so hysterical. And I'm just trying to pull it up right now. It's absolutely hilarious. But there's a whole conversation between the two of them. Catherine Hahn had the gall to compare her husband to Guy Woodhouse from Rosemary's Baby. She's like, you're Guy Woodhouse. He's like, what? The husband in Rosemary's Baby, John Cassavetes, that's you. And he's like, yeah, Rachel, that's me. Standing by while you're being raped by a satanic demon. And Paul Giamatti, if you're familiar with how Paul Giamatti delivers his lines, like, so nonchalant, and it's just so great. It's a line that only works and is funny because of how Paul Giamatti delivers it. And this is another example of a movie that balances the comedy and drama beautifully. It honestly does feel like a movie that Alexander Payne would have directed. It feels very much something like him. It's also a great New York film. As someone who lives near New York City, it's a great New York film. But it genuinely is a fantastic film. It's very underrated. It got so much critical acclaim. It ran the festival circuit throughout 2018. It premiered at Sundance and then went on to show at other film festivals. But the fact that it was just a Netflix film that didn't get the proper attention that it deserved, sometimes, and this is a discussion that I've had with many people, there are films that come out from Netflix that are way too good for Netflix. They get talked about for a little while, and then they're never talked about again. I'm just going to use The Irishman as an example. Yes, The Irishman is still pretty much talked about when you talk about the best films that Netflix has put out. But I feel like Netflix didn't give it the proper attention that it deserved. Same with Marriage Story. Sometimes these films are too good to be on a service like Netflix. And that's the case with Private Life. But it's also such, it's such an intimate, honest, earnest story about a couple trying to start a family. And they're obviously much older, so it's a lot harder for them to do that. But it's a very raw depiction, and it's so beautiful. It made me laugh. It made me cry. It made me feel so many different things. And I think that this should have been a much bigger player come that award season, because it feels like someone that is so up the Academy's wheelhouse, but unfortunately they fail to recognize it, partly because of the fact that the studio behind the film didn't campaign the crap out of this movie like they quite frankly should have. And I know Netflix has had a bit of a bumpy record with the Oscars and everything. They've gone close to win Best Picture a few times, and they haven't been able to do that. I mean, they were very close 2 years ago. They were very close with The Power of the Dog. They were right there, and then it ended up last minute not working out. Roma was a very close contender to win Best Picture. That didn't end up working out. But yeah, Paul Giamatti in Private Life is a great performance, but the film itself is really fantastic, and I highly recommend anyone out there listening, if you haven't seen Private Life, don't be like me and push off this film for a long time. I waited 5 years to watch this movie. I should have watched this when it came out, and I asked myself why I didn't do it, and I wish I had the answer. So Private Life is my number three.
Excellent choice. I still haven't seen it. But that being said, you know, Netflix has this thing where they essentially throw so much stuff at the wall. They want the one thing to stick, and then they just run with that. And so they'll throw the fact that they have big Oscar movies, it doesn't make sense to me, because you cannot convince me that their algorithm gives a crap about those movies. Like, they care about, you know, Suits, episodes of Suits that people rewatch 1,000 times, and Stranger Things and The Crown, and these things that kind of capture the zeitgeist. And these type of movies don't capture the zeitgeist. Even if they do, they're in such a small, like, they, Glass Onion last year, great example. That movie should have made $200 million.
Also with Catherine Hahn, funnily enough.
Yes. Yeah, it came and went. And, you know, Netflix, it's not necessarily they're too good for Netflix. It's that Netflix just doesn't, like, they pay all this money to buy it, and then they don't do anything with it. Like, what's the point of why do you spend the money to put all these efforts forth? And it's like, maybe they are getting the views, and maybe they are getting the cash from it. And I think that's part of the reason, like, they want to, like, that's why the Writers Guild Writers Strike and the Actors Strike's going on as long as it is. I think it's like an aspect of, like, it's essentially widespread fraud to not tell everybody how well seen these movies are. But that's a discussion for a different time. But yeah.
Yeah, you need to watch this movie, Ben. It's great.
I've heard
good.
Nothing but good things.
It's so good. Don't be like me and wait an eternity to watch it, because it's going to come and go, and you never know. Like, knowing how some of these streaming services drop their content like flies, like their own content, you never know if they're going to do that with this movie. And I hope to God they don't, because this is one of the best films that Netflix has ever produced. And I cannot stress enough how great it is. And speaking of things that we cannot stress how great they are, it's time to talk about our top two. So We definitely have one film in common for sure. We absolutely have one film in common for sure. But I'm so curious to hear what your second favorite Paul Giamatti film of all time is.
I thought you were going to say it as your number three, because you pulled an okie doke, and I was like, oh, yeah, I can't believe it. I thought I was going to be out of the ordinary. My number two, the movie that should have had Paul Giamatti his first Oscar nomination, way back in 1997, as Pig Vomit himself, Private Parts. I know it's a Howard Stern biopic. I get that. Why would you want to watch a Howard Stern biopic? I don't know. Because whenever you watch this movie, it's so much better than it has any right to be. And yes, it's a winner's view of history with, you know, Howard Stern is obviously the star of this movie. He's, you know, everything is very cleanly like, oh, look at what I did, what I didn't do, da 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 da. And, but regardless, it's a great watch. And Giamatti comes in and knocks it out of the friggin' park. As essentially like a man so angry at the fact that this guy, that Howard Stern is popular and people like him, as he is like, so essentially he plays the program manager at the new station in WNBC back in the, you know, in 1985. And as the program manager, he's like constantly finding these battles, trying to stop him from saying all the terrible things and the stupid shock jock things he always wants to say. Well, that constant battle leads to him and Howard constantly butting heads. And it's a man who played by the rules his whole life, went to the right schools, did all the right things. And it's up against a guy who doesn't do any of that. And the other guy's winning, and it just drives him insane. And he just, it's the shouty, loud, obnoxious, pathetic Giamatti. It's the perfect version of that. I mean, few things in the world, I cannot imagine a line better said than what Giamatti is. So he's so fed up with Howard Stern. And he's yelling, and he just stops and he goes, "You're the motherfucking Antichrist," and just loses it. But it's hilarious. Every line is hilarious. He's the worst. It's great. Private Parts is fantastic. Go watch it. Yes, it's a Howard Stern biopic, but yeah, and Stern's pretty good in it. You know, for being what it is. Also, I have to have a shout out to Mary McCormick, who is exceptional in the film as well. So but yeah, I love Private Parts. Every time it's on, I'm like, I'm watching this movie. Even though and whenever you get to the pig bomb stuff, I forget the guy's name. Kenny Rushton is the actual name, but Howard always called him Pig Vomit, so that's kind of what the name that it always stuck. Giamatti's one of his finest roles.
So, similar to how you said that you haven't seen Private Life, I unfortunately have never seen Private Parts.
I get it.
This is one that honestly has been on my watch list for a long time. My parents loved Howard Stern back in the day, so of course they went to go see this when it came out back in the 90s, and yeah, I've been wanted to check this out for sure. And a friend of the podcast, Seth, I'm so sorry, Seth, that this is not on my list, but you could be happy that someone had it on their list today. So no, I've always heard great things about this movie, concerned that it's a Howard Stern biopic where Howard Stern is played by Howard Stern himself.
Yep.
So I definitely need to check this out. And just hearing about, I've always heard how great Paul is in this movie, and a lot of people have considered this to be the breakout role for him, where people started being like, oh, who's this Paul Giamatti guy? Obviously, he wasn't the lead of the movie, but people were like, oh, I'm going to keep an eye on this Paul Giamatti guy. And it's always interesting to see him kind of play like sidekicks or assistants or managers to comic figures, because 2 years after this, he did Man on the Moon, which, you know, he was essentially like the comedy partner and the manager or what have you of Andy Kaufman. So yeah, it's crazy the time of Paul Giamatti in the 90s. And, you know, my number two, this may get people to be insanely churned off by the show. So I am sorry to everyone in advance, but let me explain. So every once in a while, we have a film that comes along that we watch that we can recognize is not a great movie. It might not even be a good movie. But we find a way of appreciating it for what it is and the impact that it leaves on us. And again, I can recognize that this is not some Oscar caliber film. I can understand that this is not a technical masterpiece, however you want to phrase it. But to me,
I already have a guess. I'm excited. I'm excited for you to answer because I have a guess. So go ahead. Keep going.
But for me, when I think of Paul Giamatti and I think about the films that I love from him the most, while this isn't my number one, this is the film that I have seen the most with Paul Giamatti. I have loved this film for, let's see, how many? 23 years. No, wait, 21 years, excuse me. My math was way off, so that joke is ruined. So my number two is Big Fat Liar. look, let me preface this by saying, is this a great movie? No, it's not. It's not the best comedy of all time. It's not even a great movie. But if you go to my letterbox, you will see that I rated this movie 5 stars. Everyone has that one movie in their life, at least one movie in their lives, where they could recognize that it's so bad that it's good. And to me, Big Fat Liar is a genuinely funny family comedy. I think it's hysterical. It does what a comedy is supposed to do. It makes you laugh. Sure, is it predictable from start to finish? Yes. Sure, is there anything groundbreaking about it? No, there's not. But what makes this film so fun to watch really is how much Paul Giamatti commits to the role of Marty Wolf. The things that he does in this movie, and then you watch some of his later films, you would not even think for a second it's the same guy from Big Fat Liar. When I say that this guy has range, he has range with a capital R, and it shows in Big Fat Liar. The places that he goes to in this movie are so indescribable that you have to witness it for yourself. If you're someone out there that hasn't seen Big Fat Liar, oh man, you're missing out on a great, great comedy. So essentially you have this troublemaking kid, Jason Shepherd, who's played by Frankie Muniz, and then he writes this paper, which he titles Big Fat Liar. He stumbles across this big Hollywood producer, Marty Wolf, who played by Giamatti. And he accidentally leaves the essay in this limo. And then Marty Wolf reads it and is so fascinated by it that he then decides to turn that short story into a feature film. And Jason and his best friend, who's played by Amanda Bynes, they fly to LA to go confront Marty Wolf and to get this story back. It's a silly premise. It's so fucking goofy. And it is very much a product of the time. It's very 2002. The needle drops are there. It opens with a friggin' Smash Mouth song. So you know right away that you're watching a movie from the early 2000s. It's so good, though. I've loved this movie since I was a kid. And you know sometimes you tend to watch a movie a lot when you're a kid, and then you go back to it as an adult. You're like, I don't know if this is going to hold up very well. I could recognize that Big Fat Liar is not perfect by any stretch of the imagination, but it's been a film that's been near and dear to me my whole life, and I will never stop loving it. And really, the places that Paul Giamatti goes to is just so impressive. His performance here is genuinely incredible. He's so freaking funny in this. All the facial expressions that he makes, that's the thing with Paul Giamatti too. He's a guy that could say so much with his face without actually saying something. The expressions that he makes in this film are insane. There's a particular shot after they jump out of a helicopter. And sure. It's them walking in the middle of the desert. The music's so dramatic that it's like it goes from a wide shot to a medium shot to a close-up. And the face that he makes, oh my God, it's priceless. And earlier this year, I went to Universal Hollywood, and I did the studio tour. And this is also like a Universal film, so you're like, oh, here they go, milking themselves and filming on their studio and everything. But that sequence where he's running, he's chasing the kids, and he just screams, "You can't outrun the wolf, kid!" And then the flash flood happens. It's so great. Just seeing that flash flood in person got me so excited. And everyone else is like, "Well, that's so special about this." And I'm like, "It's the flash flood from Big Fat Liar, you fuck. This is you know, this is a prime filming location right here. This is like Big Fat Liar is cinema. It's cinema." No, but seriously, and all jokes aside, I really do love Big Fat Liar. And it's so cool to see that Paul Giamatti did a film like this and then went on to do all these Oscar caliber films. Again, just shows the range that he has. And I've loved this film my whole life, and I'll never stop loving it. It makes me laugh. It always finds a way of putting a smile on my face and cracking me up. I've loved the film my whole life, and I will never stop loving it, and I will defend this film to the day I die. Everyone has that one guilty pleasure in their life, and this to me is a guilty pleasure, although I say that there are far worse comedies out there than this that somehow get more recognition than Big Fat Liar. So, Big Fat Liar, great film. I knew that it was going to be in my top two. and I have a feeling that there are people that are listening to this that are so turned off by the fact that it's in my top two that somehow I put Big Fat Liar over Private Life and American Splendor and even The Holdovers. People are like, really? That's when you put it as your number two? Yeah, damn right I put it as my number two. This is my show and this is my list and I could do whatever I want. So Big Fat Liar is my number two. So obviously this is not on your list, but I would love to hear your thoughts on Big Fat Liar.
I'm sorry. I've never seen Big Fat Liar. You know, it was... Okay, in my defense, I lived in the Middle East in parts of high school. So whenever Big Fat Liar came out, I was not physically in the country. So I did not have the ability to go see it. And then by the time I got back to the country, I was old enough to where I was actually working and like at a movie theater and like, oh, I'm a grown up teenager. I don't need to see Big Fat Liar in theaters or like, you know, kind of that when you first discover cinema, you're just like, well, I'm not going to watch this. That being said, I've watched some real crap in the theaters ever since then. But it like, I appreciate your commitment to loving a film that you recognize is terrible. I talked to a friend of mine about this, essentially like, okay, you have a movie that you love. Are you able to recognize the flaws? I think that's a big part of loving a movie as much as you can. Like, you have to be able to like, okay, you love everything about this movie. Is it perfectly flawless? No, there's this, this, and this, and this, and this. Because you've seen it 1,000 times, there's always something you can pick up on. And I appreciate the devotion to, like, I don't care what anybody else says. This is my opinion, and I'm going to stick by this opinion. It's not something that I'm going to deviate from. And I also think there's, you know, it's there are movies I don't want to rewatch because I have that pure cinematic memory of it. And if I rewatch it, it could be better, but probably not. It's probably going to be worse. And knowing those movies, and I don't want to rewatch them because I want to have that. And whenever you watch movies as your kid and you really fall in love with a movie, you have that and you're like, man, I don't want to give that up. And so I get it completely why you have Big Fat Liar at number two. And don't be wrong, I saw that trailer 1,000 times. I feel blue as hell.
you know, people.
But yeah,
people talk about Avatar like it's God's gift to cinema when it comes to blue movies. But I mean, come on, you watch Big Fat Liar, and your whole opinion's gonna change. I love Avatar, yes. So I'm not gonna call you out if you like Avatar or not. But no, Big Fat Liar. It's just when I say that he goes places that you would not expect Paul Giamatti to go to, you have to see it to believe it. And I know that you're like, I'm an adult, why would I watch Big Fat Liar? Trust me, if you want a fun guilty pleasure movie, this is a good one to watch.
I agree.
Have some drinks, do whatever it is you need to do to get yourself in the mood for this. It's a quick watch. It's only like 85 minutes long. It flies by. You don't feel the runtime. It's great. It's so great. Also, I miss you, Frankie Muniz. Please come back.
You were he's racing cars, man. He's racing cars. Let him do what he wants to do. He's doing good out there. So I mean, let him.
What a time to be alive. Big Fat Liar and what a time in the to middle, be alive. Back to back. Oh my God, that's range. Now, you want to talk about range? Oh, that's range right there. So now it's time to get into our number one favorite Paul Giamatti film of all time. I would be incredibly shocked if we do not have the same number one. I would be very, very surprised if this isn't even on your list. So tell the listeners what your favorite Paul Giamatti film of all time is.
You're not going to be shocked. It's Sideways. It's Sideways because it has to be Sideways. It's the Paul Giamatti. Like, when Paul Giamatti is dead, the first thing they will say is, Paul Giamatti, well-known character actor, especially his starring role in the film Sideways. That will be the line. That will be the line, and it should be the line. And when you look back at the history of the Academy Awards, I cannot imagine a more flabbergasted exclusion than when Giamatti did not get nominated for Best Actor for Sideways. It really baffles. I mean, and that lineup is pretty solid. That's a pretty solid lineup. At the time, in hindsight, it sucks.
Oh,
but,
absolutely.
You know, but Paul Giamatti is so good at being silently depressed. In Sideways, you can tell this guy is painfully unhappy. He is unhappy. He's unsuccessful. Everything is going wrong, but he has wine. He has wine in his life. It's the only thing that enriches him, essentially. The only thing about life that makes life worth living is his love of wine. And throughout this film, you can tell it's like this, he is not hanging on to anything. There is no desire in life. There's no love. There's nothing else keeping him around except for his love of wine. That's the only thing he wants to do. And then whenever they go on this trip, and obviously all the craziness that goes on, he discovers Virginia Madsen, and it kind of opens his world up to go, like, maybe there's something more than just this wine. And this is all done through mostly silence, through mostly quiet stares and reflection and other people talking. And I would argue it's one of the most perfectly cast foursome movies ever. Like, all four characters, Thomas Hayden Church, Madsen, and Giamatti, are all so perfectly cast at what they're doing. And it's such an incredible film. It's outside of Election, I think it's Alexander Payne's best film. You could talk me into it being the best film of his. It's probably his best written film, and shot beautifully. I rewatched it a couple. I was finishing off 2004. I was rewatching all the supporting actress nominees from that year, and I rewatched Sideways, and it was so rewarding in a rewatch. And it's his finest performance. It's still his finest performance. I know I haven't seen the holdovers, but I would be shocked if I ever see anything that Paul Giamatti does that is able to top Sideways.
So my number one film is The Amazing Spider-Man 2. So you're definitely wrong there. That's the best.
I was going to have that joke, man. Oh, so sorry. Took it already. I was going to say Mark Webb's Amazing Spider-Man 2. Yeah, exactly.
The Rhino, that's Oscar a good one. Caliber performance for sure. One of the best villains in cinema history. Not comic book history, in cinema history. Even better than Heath Ledger's Joker. No, I'm just kidding. That joke is going on way longer than it should. So, no, my number one is also Sideways. Now, Sideways, to me, this is a very special film for me because I have vocalized many times on this podcast that Catch Me If You Can might be my favorite film ever made. But a close second is actually Sideways. I don't know what it is that keeps me wanting to come back to this movie. But there's just something about the world that Alexander Payne brings to life and then brings to life the pain of the character of Miles, because like you brought up, Paul Giamatti is so good at playing depressing, lonely characters. And he's very good at showing that without telling you that he's depressed. And
yes,
I think that this is one of the most laid-back films that you could ever watch. Who would have ever thought that a movie about two guys going to wine country would be one of the best films ever made? Did anyone ever think that? I certainly didn't. Not whatsoever. But I think that this movie is so beautiful. It's so beautiful. And there's so many layers to all these characters. It's not just a great showcase for Paul Giamatti, but the supporting cast too is fantastic. Thomas Hayden Church as Jack is amazing. Great comic relief. And then you have Virginia Madsen as Maya. She is so, so good. And then on top of that, you have Sandra Oh as, oh my God, what's her name in this movie? I've seen this movie 40,000 times and I forgot her name, and it's
Stephanie.
Oh my God. The first encounter with them is so hysterical. You are a bad, bad girl, Stephanie. I know. I need to be spanked. I'm like, so kinky, so seductive. Love it so much. But no, I love this movie so much. It's so quiet. But then there's moments where it is very loud. There's moments where the comedy is pushed aside for the drama. But then there's moments where the comedy comes in and provides you the entertainment that you quite frankly need. Many sequences stick out, like the golf sequence. The golf course sequence is one of the funniest sequences in the entire film. Miles is not that good of a golfer. Jack is very good at it, and Miles is trying to make the swing, but Jack keeps distracting him, and then all of a sudden, those people that are behind them make their way into the field, and then, for once, Miles hits the perfect shot, which hits the golf cart, and just the delivery, just the deadpan comic delivery of Paul Giamatti just going, oh, whoops, look out. It's so good. And then Jack runs around maniacal and everything. It's so great. But there's so many great scenes in the film. But Paul Giamatti specifically, he's incredible in this. And you brought up some of the more nuanced moments throughout the movie. But one of the highlights in terms of his acting, when we're looking at the serious moments, is when he's in that hospital after Jack's nose is broken. And he calls Maya. And it's just that great monologue with the piano playing underneath it. And he's like, I'm not much of a writer. I'm not much of anything. Oh, my God. Pure waterworks from like there. It's just, it's so good. And it makes you ask yourself, how the fuck did he not get nominated for an Oscar for this? Considering the fact that two of his co-stars got nominated and he didn't even nominate the lead of the movie, it's honestly sickening. Considering how much of a major Oscar player this movie was. It was nominated for picture. It was nominated for director. It won Best Adapted Screenplay, which I'll give credit where credit is due. This particular Oscar ceremony gave two of my favorite screenplays of all time the Oscars. This one, Adapted Screenplay, then Eternal Sunshine, won Original Screenplay. And you know what's funny? Everyone talks about how Paul Giamatti should have been nominated for Best Actor, which he absolutely should have been. You know who else should have been nominated for Best Actor that year? Jim Carrey in Eternal Sunshine. And the fact that he wasn't is so sickening. It's honestly sickening. You brought up how that lineup is a good lineup at the time, but then you look back on it and you're like, wow, this lineup kind of sucks. Keep Jamie Foxx in. Keep Leo in. And then I don't want
to. I like Don Cheadle.
I would keep Don Cheadle in too, and then I would replace Johnny Depp and Clint Eastwood with Jim Carrey and Paul Giamatti. Like,
it's so tough. I watched Finding Neverland for the first time a couple months ago, and I watched it, and I'm like, this thing is a piece of crap. It is not good. It is a violently bad movie. It is it's.
I like it. I have a soft spot for it. I like it. I get it.
I friggin' hate it, man. It's so bad. Like, and Johnny Depp, whatever voice he's doing, Rodhaam Mitchell as the wet blanket of all wet blankets, and then Julie Christie showing up as a wet blanket to be on that wet blanket too. My God, ugh, God, it's disgusting.
And then Dustin Hoffman is there, and
why is Dustin Hoffman there? I think he was there for 2 days. It's like, what are you doing?
Come on, you have better things to do. Spot for it, but that's a different discussion for another time.
I cannot stand it. Anyway, yeah, sorry. Anyway,
no, that was on me for segueing into the best actor lineup.
Not at all.
No, I mean, this film is really exceptional, and there's so many great line deliveries from Paul as Miles that may not necessarily be funny, but it's because of how Paul says it that are funny. I mean, one of the most iconic lines in the movie is when they're outside the restaurant, and they're like, oh, Jack's like, oh, if they want to drink Merlot, they drink Merlot. Miles like, no, if anyone's leaving, no, if anyone orders Merlot, I'm leaving. I'm not drinking any fucking Merlot. It's so good. okay, relax,
classic,
Miles.
Yes.
Relax, Miles. No Merlot. Did you bring your Xanax? And then he just jiggles it, and it's just like, it's oh God, it's so great. I love it so much. And then when they crash the car to make it look like an accident, then they grab all the wine bottles that they have in the bag. He's like, you broke a couple of them, you know? Oh, it's okay. No, it's not okay, you fucking derelict. Like, who? What normal person says that to someone? What normal person calls someone a derelict? Like, just the vocabulary. It's like, you'll see similar elements of that in his performance in The Holdovers, so I'm really excited for you to see that. But, God,
I am.
Sideways is, it's literally, and I don't use this term enough, or I try to not use this a lot, but it's a masterpiece. Like, everything about it, I think, is beautiful. The writing, the directing, the acting, the editing, the score, it's just cozy. You feel good watching it. You laugh, you cry. It's a beautiful film. And the ending, I love how they
leave it
unanswered. I love how they don't show you what happens. I think it's a beautiful way of wrapping the film up. I agree that this is Alexander Payne's best movie. This is Paul Giamatti's best performance. It is kind of sickening that he didn't get any love for this movie, considering that, like I said, his two co-stars got nominated. And they're great, too. I mean, everyone's great in the movie. The four performances, they're all wonderful. But Paul is the star of the show. This is his movie front and back. He's in pretty much every scene of the... I think he's in every scene of the movie. I don't think there's a scene that he's not in. And
I think you're correct.
And it's... Man... I don't like to use the word snub, but this is one of the biggest Oscar snubs of the last 20 years, and it's kind of crazy that this movie's going to be 20 years old next year. That's absolutely nuts to me. That's absolutely wild to me. But it's one of the best films of all time. It really goes back and forth now with Catch Me If You Can. It's my possible favorite film ever made. And when I first saw the movie, I was like 15 years old, so obviously I didn't care about wine. But now, it being 10 years since I've watched the movie for the first time, and I'm slowly getting interested in wine, I actually owe a lot of that to this film. Like, I didn't know any jack shit about Merlot and Cabernet and Chardonnay and Sauvignon Blanc. Like, I didn't know anything about any wine. And then I watched this movie, and I just was like, wow, I really want to drink wine and everything. And this movie really makes me want to go to wine country. I need to cross it off the bucket list just because of how much I love Sideways. But yeah, it would have been very remiss of me to not have Sideways as my number one Paul Giamatti film, because it's not only my favorite thing that he's been in, but I also stand by this being the best thing that he's ever been in. And it's going to be hard, like you said, for anything to top this as the best thing that Paul Giamatti has ever been in.
Yeah, I agree. It's just like it'll stand the test of time as the thing that people know him from.
Absolutely.
And maybe something else will come along that maybe gets him some more recognition or something like that, but it'll be in one of the first few things. That's what you think of him as. And whenever you think of Paul Giamatti, that's what you go to.
100%. So before we get into talk about some of the films that didn't make the cut, let's recap our list from 5 to 1. So, Ben, what is your list?
Number five is Straight Outta Compton. Number four is Cinderella Man. Number three, The Illusionist. Number two, Private Parts. And number one, Sideways.
And to recap my list, coming on number five is American Splendor. Number four is The Holdovers. Number three, Private Life. Number two, Big Fat Liar. And number one, Sideways. We only had one film in common, and it happened to be our number ones.
Yes. I almost had American Splendor, but...
You were very close. You were very close. But no, that's crazy. We only had one film in common. What are the odds? So, you know, to talk about some of the films that didn't make the cut, what are some films that you want to give a shout out to that didn't make your list?
So, you talked about like a movie with that you saw a lot when you were a kid. There was a movie. So, whenever I was living overseas, we didn't have many English speaking channels, but when we did, they were essentially movie channels, and they ran the same lineup of a lot of movies over and over again. And one of them is the movie The Negotiator with Samuel Jackson and Kevin Spacey. And Paul Giamatti is in that film as kind of like this slimy, like accountant guy. And I love The Negotiator, and I just wanted to shout out to The Negotiator because he's good in The Negotiator, and I really enjoy it. Another movie that I very much recognized the flaws at the time when it came out. I thought it was hilarious. I thought it was satire, and then apparently nobody else agreed with me. Shoot 'em Up with Clive Owen, a incredibly violent, like almost a pro-gun movie, but Paul Giamatti's having the time of his life in that movie. Having a lot of fun there. And then like I said, the small parts that he gets in, you know, My Best Friend's Wedding, Truman Show, Saving Private Ryan, 12 Years a Slave. Like just, he shows up, steals a minute, and then nopes out and you never see him again. It's great.
Yeah. For me, I'm going to shout out Man on the Moon, which I gave a bit of a shout out to earlier. I love Man on the Moon. I think it's fantastic. And talk about another film that Jim Carrey should have been nominated for an Oscar for. Jim Carrey should have three Oscar nominations to his name, and he should honestly have two Oscar wins to his name. I'm just saying, like, come on, Academy. But yeah, Man on the Moon is amazing. I mean, The Truman Show obviously is also great, but Paul's role is pretty small in that. But I mean, I can't pass on talking about another one of the best films of all time, so I have to give that a shout out. Win-Win from Tom McCarthy, which is actually a New Jersey film, so it's kind of a bit of a soft spot for me. It's a New Jersey film, so I have a bit of a soft spot for movies like that. And he's great in the movie. He's so good in this. It's a very intimate, independent dramedy from Tom McCarthy, who's best known for directing Spotlight, and he also made The Station Agent. But I really like Win-Win, and it's one that I was going to rewatch for this podcast, but I just didn't have enough time to do that. Ides of March from George Clooney, fantastic political drama. I don't give a shit about these kinds of movies at all. Believe it to George Clooney and that entire cast for making me so engrossed with a movie about politics. Oh, and Paul is so slimy in this, too. He's so great in this. He's so good in this. You want to talk about a movie where he has a little role but somehow finds a way of stealing the scene that he's in? Saving Mr. Banks. I grew up loving Mary Poppins. So when it was announced that there was a movie being made about the making of Mary Poppins, but also kind of focusing on elements of P.L. Travers' life, I love that movie so much. I recently rewatched it when I was on a Disney cruise a couple months ago, and I always find something new to appreciate about that movie. And Paul is so good in it. His role is very small. He's P.L. Travers' driver. And he just wants to talk and everything. Like, he's such a wholesome guy. Like, this is one of those roles from Paul Giamatti where you're like, oh, I just want to give the guy a hug. He's just such a sweet, humble man. And then P.L. Travers being like, you can't talk to me while I'm doing this and everything. But then they start a friendship. He's like the one American that she likes. She's like, you're the only American I ever liked, Ralph. Like, she made that joke to him. But, like, it's some of the most intimate moments in the film, like the sequences between him and Emma Thompson. It's so, so good. And then, yeah, Straight Outta Compton you brought up. Love and Mercy is a great honorable mention. And that's really it. Although, I love his performance in San Andreas. That's a fun little disaster movie. That's a fun little disaster movie. And honestly, whenever Paul's on screen, it's really
he's
really great.
Walking, talking exposition.
Walking, talking exposition. I mean, but then there's that sequence where they're at the Hoover Dam and then it explodes and he's just like, "Everybody run!" And like him screaming and everything. I love it. It's great. And then he screams his heart out in Jungle Cruise, which that movie kind of sucked. But he was really funny in it because There's a chase sequence and he just screams Dwayne Johnson's name from the top of his lungs. And it's like, oh, this is why we love Paul.
Yes, yes.
But yeah, it's great. There's so much to love about Paul Giamatti. And there's actually, like, his TV stuff. I actually haven't really dabbled in his TV stuff. So I haven't seen John Adams or I haven't watched Billions either.
Me neither.
I'm bummed because John Adams, I love a good historical drama, and I've heard nothing but incredible things about John Adams, and he works with Laura Linney, and it's directed by Tom Hooper, and this was before he became the Oscar-winning darling that he became, and I definitely need to check it out. I absolutely need to check it out.
I agree. I think I need to as well.
And Billions, I mean, it seems like not necessarily a wannabe Succession, but it sounds like a show that if you like Succession and you love following like hedge funds and families that work in the finance industry and what have you, this is a show to check out. So I definitely want to check that out for sure. And I love that he was on Big Mouth. I'm sorry, he didn't play a testicle. I have to rephrase. He voiced Andrew's shit. That's what he voiced. I don't know why
It's good to get that clarification. It's good to get that clarification out of the world because, things.
I thought he played a testicle. I feel so – I thought he played – someone voices somebody's in that show, but I forgot. It's been a long time since I've watched Big Mouth. That's a funny show, though. But, yeah, I mean, to close out on Paul Giamatti, what can we say? He's one of the most underrated actors working today. He's very well-known, but he doesn't get the notoriety that he deserves. I've been a fan of Paul Giamatti since I was a kid. For the last 20-plus years, I have loved Paul Giamatti. And as I get older, I'll continue being a fan of Paul Giamatti. I'm bummed that the last decade or so, he's been primarily getting supporting roles. But it's so nice to finally see him as the lead of a movie again. And I'm hoping that with the success of The Holdovers, it's going to catapult him back to getting more leading roles. Because quite frankly, he deserves to be a leading man more often than other leading men. I've loved Paul Giamatti for a long time, and I will be a fan of him until he decides to step down from acting. So, Ben, what are your final thoughts on Paul Giamatti?
Whenever I think of quality, who delivers it every time, it's Paul Giamatti, because he is a guy who is fully committed to whatever role he gets. It doesn't matter if he's playing a friggin' rhino in Spider-Man 2, or if he's playing an exposition-spouting meteorologist in San Andreas, or if he's playing a tortured, failed writer on a wine trip, or if he's playing the station manager trying to keep Howard Stern under wraps. It all works, because Paul Giamatti's commitment and his ability to deliver the levels that the character needs. A guy who is not afraid to look silly, to look stupid, to be pathetic, to be depressed. A guy who is not unwilling to show that to the world. And his immense talent is not lost on me. And I'm with you. I'm hoping that The Holdovers is able to send him back into the leading man stratosphere. After he does San Andreas too, obviously.
Oh, of course. You know, I've been waiting for a St. Andreas 2 for a long time. Like, where is it? Come on, The Rock. Like, give me more St. Andreas, please.
It's on his IMDb, so, I mean, it's coming, I guess.
I would certainly hope so. So, Ben, thank you so much for coming on to the show today to talk to me about Paul Giamatti. It was such a blast having you on. Again, to hear why you love Paul Giamatti. So, thank you so much for coming on today.
It's my immense pleasure. Thank you so very much for having me. I get liking to get to talk about somebody I actually do like to talk about. So it's nice. It's nice.
Absolutely. And tell the audience where they can find you online.
You can find me on Twitter at NebIsBen, on Letterboxd at NebIsBen, on Instagram at Neb.IsBen. You can check out my website, IceCreamForFreaks.com. You can follow my other writings on The Film Experience and Cinema Scholars. You can also find me on other podcasts, as I'm the David Thewlis of podcasting. I also have my own podcast, Target Audience, which releases episodes weekly. I talk to a guest who is the target audience of a film they choose, and it's a podcast about empathy. So I try to empathize with their love of a film.
Sounds great. I will put the links for all that in the description below, and you guys can follow me on all socials at Brian Suffield. You guys can find this show on any podcast platform of your choice. We have a Twitter and Instagram, so you guys can stay up to date with what's going on in Film Fragments. Let us know your favorite Paul Giamatti films, and let us know how excited you are for the holdovers. Thank you so much for listening to this episode, guys. Be on the lookout for more great content coming your way. Lots of great topics, lots of great guests, so stay tuned, and I will see you guys for the very next episode of Film Fragments. Take care, everybody.